Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So let's start out with a rather chilling lawsuit that has just been placed. It's a whistleblower lawsuit, and it's being placed by a gentleman named Patrick Chase. He's worked in the organ transplant and procurement business for quite some time, and his whistleblower claims are really quite astonishing. In 2000, he made a report to the doctors at Parkland Hospital detailing some of his claims. Because these never got acted on, he's filed a whistleblower suit with the Justice Department. He's an industry veteran, as I said. He's had 15 years experience at transplant centers. And he said that the way that the United States collects and distributes life-saving organs has been corrupted by greed, lax oversight, and methods designed to maximize payments for Medicare. Well, we're going to go into a lot of that self-interest, but we're going to talk about Parkland Hospital and University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, primarily in the first part of this, two hospitals that are very, very close to each other and just an ambulance drive away. He claims that a disproportionate share of poor people were not getting organs that were intended. They were on the list. They came to the top of the list. The next kidney that matched was supposed to be there, but instead, those kidneys were redirected to patients at the nearby UT Southwestern Medical Center, which is a very prestigious academic hospital caring for a much more affluent population. Think Stanford Light, if you want to get a sense for the cred that that has in the marketplace. The Washington Post broke this story. They looked at the lawsuit and also a presentation that Chase made back in 2020 showing that 36 times in the previous year, kidneys had become available to Parkland patients, but the transplants didn't happen because the doctors looked at the kidneys and said, well, there's a problem with this organ. It's not suitable for donation. Now, evaluating and rejecting donated organs is a normal part of the transplant process. But in those 36 cases, Mr. Chase was able to document that doctors, the same doctors, subsequently transplanted those rejected kidneys into a patient at UT Southwestern Medical Center. This is all three sides of the organ transplant system are being named as in malfeasance sorts of claims. The nonprofit groups that solicit and procure organ donations, the government contractor that maintains the waiting list for hopeful recipients, and the transplant centers where the operations are done. According to Chase, all three of these have been corrupted by financial incentives. Now, of course, the people who are being named here are not talking because, hey, it's a lawsuit. We're not going to talk to the Post, so I want to emphasize this is a one-sided story. But let's go back to 1972, when a law was passed in the United States that said Medicare will pay for, well, just about effectively all kidney transplants performed in the United States. And that works out to about 28,000 in the last year we have data for, which is 2024. As recently as 2022, a Senate Finance Committee blamed 70 deaths on mistakes in the screening of organs. More recently, government investigators found that at least 28 times, an organ procurement group serving Kentucky and parts of West Virginia and Ohio may have initiated organ recovery before the patient was confirmed dead. This is not what we're trying to do. Every potential donor's life has to be treated with great respect, or the bottom is going to fall out of the donation supply. And doing something in any way that affects our confidence that our loved ones are brain dead before their organs are harvested is extremely important. So getting down to specifics, the transplant procurement process, the three that Chase talks about are three that he's worked with, Live On New York, New Jersey Sharing Network, and Southwest Transplant Alliance, were so focused on maximizing reimbursements that they actually collected hundreds of organs, which predictably were not viable for transplant. And they did that because there's a guaranteed Medicare reimbursement for kidneys. So every kidney they harvest is a kidney they get paid for, whether it's one that would be presumably okay for transplant or not. Their rate of rejection of kidneys was 33%. The average discard rate, according to researchers, is about 22%. They were always hanging around looking for kidneys. Chase alleges that one patient was actually brought to the operating room for organ recovery when he was, quote, not actually deceased. Now, that's an allegation, but it's a scary one. There are other charges. I'm not going to go through all of that, but the organization that's supposed to keep track of the waiting list and organize and monitor the U.S. organ transplant system is, according to Chase, falling down on the job. This is called the United Network for Organ Sharing. It's been reported, again, by the Senate Finance Committee that they are engaging in or not engaging in oversight, that they are protecting industry interests instead of patients. And rather than perform oversight in practice, they've been engaging in cover-ups and whistleblower retaliation. Greg Siegel, a co-founder of a group called Organize, which seeks reform of the transplant industry, charges that UNOS needs to be removed as the contractor immediately. And so I guess when they find out about these things, he reported to UNOS in February 2020 about the Parkland patients being bypassed. And that was it. The doctor said, oh, no, that's not happening. And that was it for oversight. At Trinity Health's Loyola University in Illinois, which a place where Chase also worked, doctors were focused on boosting revenue. They were reckless in choosing organ recipients and basically picking people who really weren't healthy enough to undergo the arduous process of a kidney transplant. And to hide these failures, Chase alleges, the hospital kept three sets of books. If a Loyola transplant patient died in the operating room, the records would call it a graft failure and therefore a transplant-related death. They did not record it as a death during transplant. In other words, you know, nothing to see here. Lots of hospitals keep different records for billing purposes. But realistically, it's hard to refute. Patients at UT Southwestern, the profitable hospital, came off of the waiting list four times faster than people at Parkland, which includes the county's indigent population. Again, they keep switching the kidneys to the other hospital and leaving the people whose turn it is and who've been on dialysis for a long time getting sicker and sicker, well, basically out in the cold. Let's go on to scientific journals. Why do we have them? We have them so that they can provide accurate, peer-reviewed reports of new research. But according to a paper that came out August 4th, there's a lot of scientific fraud going on in the scientific literature, and it's happening on a massive scale, and it's growing quickly, and the fix is in, and they've got some scary tricks here. It's long been clear that publication fraud rarely comes from lone fraudsters. Instead, there are companies called paper mills that prepare fake scientific papers that are full of made-up experiments and bogus data. They use AI, and they sell the authorship to academics who are looking to boost their publication numbers so that they can be advanced, so that they can have published journals, because it's publish or perish in their world, so they have an incentive. And research conducted by a doctor, Luis Nunez Amaral, he's a physicist at Northwestern University in Chicago and the senior author of a paper that was published about scientific fraud in this last August. He suggests that some of the journal editors may be unknowingly knowingly waving these papers through. His article also suggests that there's a subset of journal editors who are responsible for the majority of questionable papers. And they did this statistically. They looked at all of the papers published on the Public Library of Science 1, which is a well-regarded journal, which has 18,329 editors. Someone is responsible for each paper. Most editors are academic who agree to oversee and do peer review along with their research. It's like doing charity care for the poor as a doctor. It's something that you don't get paid for, but you do it because it's, you know, an obligation, kind of a thing that you do to be honorable in your field. So PLOS published over 500,000 articles, and 702 of them have been retracted. That's a pretty good record. 2,000 of them, so that's getting up to 1%, 2241, have received comments on a site called PeerPub, which is where people look at a paper and say, yeah, I think something's rotten in Denmark, can publish that, kind of put it on a bulletin board. So the editors looked at the data, and here's what they found. They found 45 editors who facilitated the acceptance of retracted or flagged articles much more frequently than would be expected by chance. So they were responsible for the peer review process of only 1.3% of all of those 276,956 articles. It's only 1.3% of them, but those papers were responsible for 30% of the retracted articles. Something is rotten in Denmark. More than half these editors were themselves authors of one of the papers later retracted. What's more, when they submitted their own papers to the journal, they regularly suggested each other as editors. And so it's kind of like a cabal of people cooperating to pass on each other's articles. Now, Dr. Amaral did not name the editors, but Nature, a science magazine, kind of used his analysis to track down five, and all five were investigated and dismissed between 2020 and 2022. And those who responded to Nature's inquiry denied wrongdoing. It's all a coincidence. But the scary thing is that I'm not sure that even the good-hearted editors have time to really crunch the numbers. And all of this relies on people not making up their data. But if the data is made up, then the statistics are going to be beautiful, and there's really no way to catch it. So when you look at, for example, recommendations, and we'll be addressing recommendations from, you know, large think tanks like, you know, the American College of Cardiology. That sounds, you know, really important, but actually the American College of Cardiology may in fact be unduly influenced by the pharmaceutical industry. And there's at least indirect evidence of that, plus direct evidence that many of the people who write the consensus statements that create the guidelines, that essentially we doctors feel that if we follow these guidelines, we're more or less, you know, playing in the safe zone as far as a malpractice case, because we are following, you know, consensus research-based data. Well, what if the research is fake or wrong? And we're not even getting into the journals which basically are just there to charge somebody to publish. So it's a pay-to-play situation. And these journals are really hard to pick apart. And when I go, and I will tell you, when I go to the internet and someone says, well, have you heard of Dr. Warren Wilson White? And I'm like, no. So what's his trip? And they're talking about, let's say, ivermectin as being good for arthritis and, you know, great for you because it prevents cancer and you should take it every day. And so you look at you go to the website, and most of the time there aren't any references or bibliographies, but when there are bibliographies, they list articles, and these articles look like real scientific articles, And if you go and read the scientific articles, sometimes they're actually about the thing that they purport to be about, but not always. And sometimes they say what they purport in Dr. Wilson White's website about how wonderful the ivermectin is. Here's why it works. Here's what it is. And look, we've got all these papers. So sometimes those papers are actually published in journals where the author pays a couple of thousand dollars to have the thing published, and it's called a processing fee. But there is no peer review. And we sort of, and if I want to know if something is good, I have to essentially go in and look to see if they're listed on one of the three or four national guardians, if you will, of quality data. And PubMed, for example, if they look at the journals and they critique the journals, and if the journals are fishy, they come off of the good journal list until they straighten up their act or disappear. I'm getting exhausted just thinking about it. So I guess the one thing that I can say is the new bombshell thing is much less likely to be true than the thing that's been boringly replicated, you know, in 5 or 10 different major studies. You can sort of, when something comes out that blows the old convention out of the water, you want to take a deep breath and look carefully and make sure that we've got an apples to apples comparison. And that can be hard. You know, that's one of the services I try to provide here, is keeping the data straight. And we're going to be moving into some major revisions of what you may have heard from your doctor that are really not revisions. They're going back to what was established over decades of data and got blown out of the water by one sexy study, and that seduced the American College of Cardiology in the case of both of the things we'll be talking about. Moving on to something you probably haven't heard that much about, but I've been seeing it pop up lately, and I am happy to provide you with something that may help you get deeper, more high-quality restorative sleep. So everybody's heard about melatonin. Let's just talk briefly about how that works. Sleep is regulated by the 24-hour clock. It's an internal clock that's synchronized by light and darkness. And in our modern world, with blue light pollution at night and all the screens, we often have trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep. Melatonin is the transitional hormone. It signals the body to prepare for sleep. It's the go-to-sleep hormone, but it's not the stay-asleep hormone. Now, sleep itself goes through distinct stages. There's light sleep, there's deep non-rapid eye movement sleep, or non-REM, and there's rapid eye movement sleep, REM, each playing a unique role. Physical restoration is your deep non-REM. Memory consolidation is your REM. And emotional regulation, that's also the deep sleep. There are lots of things that influence these processes, and there are various dietary processes we'll talk about that support melatonin synthesis. There are other things that reduce stress hormones. And there's a lot of confusion about how to use melatonin and what melatonin does. It really is important to think of melatonin as a signal. And then once it's done its thing with the signaling, it is released through the rest of the night at a low level, but that isn't really maintaining sleep as much as you may think. Another signal, or rather a compound that can be used to switch gears and get you into deeper sleep, is something called holy basil. This is a big part of Ayurvedic. It's the active compound is called oximum, O-C-I-M-U-M. And ideally, you want to go for about a 5% extra 5% percentage of that, and trying to find product that's standardized for that is difficult. But what Oximum does is it lowers cortisol release, and it antagonizes cortisol-releasing factor receptors. So it basically prevents that middle-of-the-night stress spike that wakes you up. Certainly that's very exaggerated in women who are going through the menopause. But as we age, that waking up in the middle of the night becomes extremely common. Another thing that Oximum does is it inhibits the orexin pathways that promote wakefulness. There's just one drug, it's called Prosombra, and that also inhibits orexin, but all of the other sleep aids that we've got work on different pathways. Mainly, the holy basil, I think, is something, if you feel like you're not getting that deep restorative sleep or you're waking up in the middle of the night, this might be something you would want to give a try. A good dose would be about 500 milligrams of an aqueous extract. It's aqueous extract. What's that? Well, among other things, it's a tea. And this is available as tea, 500 milligrams of aqueous leaf extract. I'm not sure how many cups of tea you would have to drink for that. But I do see that one of my favorite companies, which is Now NOW, a very ethical company that tests its stuff and stands by its purity, but is also cost-effective, has a 500-milligram aqueous leaf extract. I don't get any reimbursement from anybody for my product recommendations, and I rarely name a product. But when I was looking through the maze of things available, I had the sense that I would probably need to give you a little bit of guidance. So I would love to hear back from my listeners if anyone does give this a try and finds that they're sleeping through the night. And I'm going to pick myself up some and see if it helps me out with that deep all-night sleep that can start to be a holy grail as you become a senior adult. And moving on, this is something that everybody with osteoporosis needs to prick up their ears and listen to. I've spent a lot of time on this program talking about osteoporosis and its causes. I've emphasized proton pump inhibitors, and I have some interesting additional information. I mean, I've already told you that it impacts B12 and it impacts the absorption of calcium. But a secondary effect, which is a downstream effect, is that if you don't absorb enough calcium from your diet because you're taking a proton pump inhibitor, your low calcium level in your bloodstream will trigger that. That is a no bueno thing, okay? The body will not accept a low calcium in the bloodstream. So if you're not bringing it in through the gut, it's going to take it out of the biggest bank of calcium you've got in your body, which is to say your bones. It's going to release parathyroid hormone, which is going to pull calcium out of your bones and put it in your bloodstream to keep your heart beating. Good choice, but not a choice you really want to force your body to make. There's also some evidence that proton pump inhibitors may actually directly impact bone remodeling, but that data is, I would say, early and not a sure thing yet, but if it's true, all the more reason. Now, the FDA requires an osteoporosis warning label on prescription acid blockers, but not on the over-the-counter versions. Oh, my God, why not? Well, back in 2011, the agency said, well, over-the-counter products are low-dose, and they're only marketed for short 14-day courses, so they're unlikely to be a problem. Yeah, they're available over-the-counter, and you can buy big boxes of them, or you can buy a large number of boxes of them. So why wouldn't this be a problem? People need to know this is not benign. Among people using proton pump inhibitors for 4 years, the risk of a hip fracture increases by 217%. In other words, just a little over double compared to non-users. And not only do they weaken bones, but they also raise the risk of falls. Data analysis of over 350,000 patients found that proton pump inhibitors increased the overall risk of falls by 27%. and falls leading to hospitalizations by 61%. Maybe some of that's the B12. It's also true that it depletes magnesium. Again, you need that acid to absorb magnesium, and that can have effects on muscle function, falls again maybe, and brain function. But this is the one that really kind of blew my mind. Antidepressants and osteoporosis is actually a big deal, and I had no idea of this. 1 in 9 individuals over the age of 18 took depression drugs in 2023. More than 15% of U.S. women took antidepressants. Well, guess what? They're the ones who are most at risk for osteoporosis. Adolescents and young people, teenagers, are taking far more antidepressants than they used to, and they're in the process of mineralizing their bones. There was a Canadian study that tracked patients for 10 years. They found that taking either a serotonin selective reuptake inhibitor or a selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor was associated with a 68% of fracture risk. Women taking SSRIs lost bone at a rate of more than 1.6 times faster than women who weren't on these antidepressants. Statistically, for every 42 patients taking an SSRI, one of them would be expected to break a hip, wrist, or forearm. Then they sliced and diced the literature a little bit differently. They looked at the data. And even taking the drug for just 1 year increased fracture risk. For every 19 patients taking an antidepressant from 1 to 5 years, one would be expected to break a bone. And then the last drug that we don't think about, or we should think about more, are androgen deprivation therapy. Now, these are drugs that are used in polycystic ovary. They're drugs that are often used in case of various hormonal cancers. These drugs create osteoporosis by increasing inflammation and stimulating bone breakdown. So it's not just a fake menopause. Bone loss has been detected in patients as young as 29 after only 3 months of treatment. And the loss of testosterone in both men and women leads to muscle weakness, decreased strength. These drugs are used for cancer. If you're a man with prostate cancer taking one of these drugs, you lose about 5% of your bone mass within 1 year of starting it. And 43% of prostate cancer patients developed osteoporosis after 2 years. By 4 years, the number was up to 50%. By year 10, and these agents are continued for that amount of time, the rate of osteoporosis is 81%. Aromatase inhibitors, another drug that is often given to women with breast cancers, they lose bone rapidly for the 5 years or so that they're on these agents. And after 5 years on a aromatase inhibitor, 1 in every 5, that's 20% of women, suffered a bone fracture. Now, these drugs can be life-changing, and I'm saying that we want to use them for limited amounts of times. We want to be sure that there is a clear benefit because we are taking a risk. And we want to take additional steps, real aggressive steps, to preserve bone mass. And that includes things like weight-bearing exercise, especially doing exercise on vibration tables, jumping jacks, jumping rope, lots of vitamin D, lots of vitamin K. Just all of the things, the simple things that we know are so important and so critical. I mean, if you were one of these women taking this drug for your breast cancer, and all I told you was don't drink cola drinks, diet or sugar, doesn't matter, don't drink cola drinks because those are going to increase your bone loss, that's a little something you could give up. Add to that, 5 minutes of jumping rope or a day, add to that calcium and vitamin D and vitamin K in the appropriate dose combinations, and you're starting to take a little bit of that bone back. And why don't we do that? Why don't we tell patients that? Why am I telling the whole world so that maybe somebody who's listening will actually get a benefit? It's crazy how we don't close the loop. So let's close the loop on dyslipidemia. This is from an editorial in American Family Physician. I just want to start off by saying, if you've ever gotten your lipid panel at Quest and you see, and you look at it and you see all of these reds and you think, oh my God, I've got high cholesterol. And then there's a paragraph below that and it says, you know, blah, 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 recommendations, blah, blah. And then it says LDL less than 100 for primary prevention. And that is a lie. That's pure and simple a lie. That is not the guidelines. That is not what the Veterans Affairs Department says. It's not even what the American College of Cardiology says. All right, I'm going to read to you what the recommendations are for primary prevention of heart disease. That is to say, you don't have heart disease, you haven't had a heart attack, you haven't had a stroke. Who should even get a statin? Veterans Administration, who is going to, as far as I'm concerned, they are the most objective source because they're going to pay for the drug or they're going to pay for the heart attack. So they are looking to minimize their cost. And if so what they use is an LDL of greater than 190 is when you put people on a medium dose statin. Not only just an LDL, an LDL above 90, or I should say, a 12% 10-year cardiovascular risk. And there are a bunch of cardiovascular risk calculators out there, and you put in your lipids and your family history and your smoking history, and it pops out, and your age, of course, and your sex, and it pops out a statistical risk. So greater than 12% 10-year risk, yeah, go on a low-dose statin. If you have diabetes, you probably want to consider being on a statin if your risk is between 6 and 12%. And why is that? Because diabetes is a risk multiplier. But that thing in the Quest lab form that you get makes it sound like you should be shooting for 100. And you should not be shooting for 100. You should not worry if you have a 134. There's just nothing to back that up. Even the American College of Cardiology says there's nothing to back that up. And so what we want to do right now is we want to get our head around secondary prevention. Secondary prevention means you've had a heart attack, you've had a stroke. Well, in that situation, you should probably be on a moderate dose statin. But the data for going on high dose statins is really thin. High dose statins cause diabetes. Diabetes is a worse risk multiplier than your LDL. So by giving people high-dose statins, which have never been shown scientifically to reduce event rates, we really need to just step back, step away from what it says on your Quest lab form, which is designed to make you want to take a drug, and just realize that the data don't support anything close to that. And again, is your 10-year risk above 12%? Because of other factors, then yeah, you probably do need a statin. And certainly if you're diabetic, maybe even a lower rate. But we're getting really crazy, and just looking at the LDL is a great way to mislead yourself. Okay, we've got a caller on the line.
Hi, my name is Tori. I'm calling from Santa Cruz.
Hi, Tori.
So the thing that was happening with me was that my ears started itching really, really bad.
Yeah.
And I just kept scratching them. And then it was really like painful, like allergies. And the next day my eyes were puffy.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I was worried that I had fleas. And so I sprayed some Wondricide cedar oil.
Was that before or after your eyes got red and puffy?
Before, mm-hmm. But my eyes weren't red. They were just puffy.
Mm-hmm.
And my my ears had been itching, and I thought that the fleas were biting my ears.
Was it the inside of the ear or the outside of the ear that was itching?
The outside.
Okay. And you hadn't gotten any new hair products or, you know, dye or anything like that, and nothing could have been...
I had a haircut, and the edges of my hair were kind of bristly.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't usually get my hair cut that short.
You know, it could have aggravated the situation, but I don't think by itself it would account for the itching. I guess it's possible. Usually when a person is having an allergic reaction or some kind of histamine release in the skin, it's like this cascade. First you get histamine, and then the histamine irritates the itch receptors. And those itch receptors, they're very, very sensitive. They're designed so that you can feel an ant crawling on your ear or whatever, you know. So they're there for a reason. But if they get chemically turned on, then there doesn't need to be anything crawling on your ears, and you're going to feel like there's stuff crawling on your ears. So, but they'll also, your ears will also be pinker. And so
They were.
Uh-huh. Okay. So,
and they started getting dry.
Mm-hmm. Did they scale, flaky?
Yeah, they scaled a little bit.
All right. Now, it's...
I had to get some Benadryl and some loratadine.
Mm-hmm. Good. Were those oral or...
Oral.
Yeah. Okay.
And hydrocortisone made my ears feel way worse.
That's interesting. I wonder if you might have been just so sensitive that the, the hydrocortisone has preservative in it, and it has a vehicle. Sometimes the drug itself can be irritating, even though the intention is to turn down irritation. It sounds like, to me like things were really ramped up. And there are other possibilities. Sometimes people will get that if they've eaten something, but usually it won't just be on the face or the head. Unless it involves the tongue, if you got like tongue swelling.
There was a little bit of a rash on my arm too, but my mouth was fine.
Right. So you probably had some histamine release going on, and I can't really tell you what caused it, but it's both sides of your body, so it's more likely to be a systemic thing rather than a contact thing. And the reason I asked about the hair is, you know, they use stuff on your hair when you go to a salon that maybe you don't use, you know, conditioners and sprays and this, that, and the other thing. And, of course, dyes, which really can cause a reaction. So most of these sorts of reactions will be fairly short-lived, say, you know, 3 to 7 days, and then they just kind of evaporate. Is that, are you getting better yet? And how long has it been?
I'm getting better, but when I come in, I went out today, and when I came home, I thought I didn't see the puffiness, and now that I've been home for a while, I feel like it looks a little puffy again.
Well, you know what? Sunlight might have triggered it a little.
Yeah, also, I used to exercise, and like really well. You know, not too much, but really well. And then I didn't exercise for like 3 or 4 weeks. And then I was reading about how when you exercise, it can help move the allergens out.
You know, I think that you're not exercising is probably a coincidence, and that there was a more direct cause. That's just, you know, years of clinical experience.
Did I have an infection?
Probably not. Infections tend to pulse, so they don't just itch. You'll get increased blood flow, and it won't. It'll get like you feel your heartbeat in your ears, and the skin will get more and more sore, and more hot, and more red. And it would be really weird to have an infection on both ears.
Uh-huh.
Infections usually are in like bacterial infections anyway, in a single location. And if you have a rash from a virus, it's usually everywhere. And what you're dealing with isn't everywhere. So I think there's some environmental factor, maybe a contact factor.
Maybe mold?
They would be more generalized. You would expect a more generalized reaction. Plus, especially with mold and dust a respiratory reaction, which you haven't described.
Oh, okay. Well,
I'm glad it's getting better. You know, I think I would just hang tight and maybe get in touch with the salon and get a list of what ingredients they used on you before too much time goes by. Like, did you use, you know, this is the conditioner you used, or this is the gel, that kind of thing. You know, get the products, and then get a picture of the stuff on the back of the package, you know, because there'll be all of these polysyllabic things like dimethicone, trimethicone, quadrimethicone, sulfate, and you're like, what is that?
I was so hurt. I thought I was developing a new allergy to silver.
Well, it's possible, but it's rare for people to get allergic to sometimes the cheaper silver that's like that's got a lot of other things like tin in it is possible. But it should be really concentrated around the piercings. And
oh, yeah, because the piercing area felt fine.
There you go. So I don't think so. Honey, I don't think we're going to solve this one, but I hope I've given you some ideas. But really, seriously, get a list of the stuff that you came in contact with at that salon visit. And then if you get it again, do the same thing. And then pull out the two lists and say, okay, what's in both files? And now you've got a short list of things to avoid.
Okay, thank you. Have a nice day.
Thank you for the call. Have a good day. Bye-bye. Oh, well, we've got another call coming in, so we will, in fact, take that call. Hello, this is Dr. Motika. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Motika. I would love to ask you a question. This is Stephen in Prunedale, and I wanted to ask you a question referencing what you were talking about, cholesterol and statins.
Yes.
I have a calculated LDL of 155,
mm-hmm.
And I was recently put on a statin, Lipitor. I've heard all sorts of terribly bad things about statins and was really very hesitant to want to start taking this, but I have been taking it for a while. I've tried several other statins in the past, which I had adverse reactions to. But this one seems to be okay for me. But after hearing you talk about, you know, what the VA study had and being something greater than, 190, I think you said?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of if 190 and you have to have a risk, you have to have a high risk. So my question
right.
for you is, do a risk calculator. If you go cardiac
well,
risk
I haven't
calculator.
Had a heart attack or stroke.
Yeah. But there may be family, the cardiac risk factor is, it's like a mathematical equation that mm-hmm. weights differently depending on your age and your school and your this, that, and the other thing, your smoking history, your family history.
Mm.
And you plug all of these known factors in mm-hmm. and then you say, what's my statistical 10-year risk? It's just like, what's my statistical risk of dying in an air crash, right? It's about that meaningful, but it is meaningful in the sense that if your statistical cardiovascular risk for your 10-year risk is 25%, then heck yeah, be on the statin, no argument.
Sure.
There's so many things that go into this, and we overemphasize, the point really is we're overemphasizing and overselling the LDL, and we're
mm-hmm.
It's cosmetic practically for and it makes when I wear my cosmetics, it makes me feel better about myself. It probably makes other people feel better about me. And the fact is, though, it's cosmetic. I'm not any healthier and I'm not any younger.
Sure. Well, my statistical evaluation is usually like 10 people get on an elevator and 9 get off. So, you know, how do I feel about that in terms of my risk factor? Do you feel that there are negatives to taking statins?
Yes, I do. And they're well established that, mm-hmm. and it has to do also with some of it we can measure because we have people who are kind of statin canaries. So they'll have big risks of statins. First of all, the really horrific risk is rhabdomyolysis, which is where your muscles just decide to dissolve. And the myoglobin, which is very similar to hemoglobin, it's an iron, it's a molecule wrapped around iron, and it holds oxygen in the muscle because you're using a lot of oxygen. And the myoglobin breaks apart into and goes and clogs up the kidneys, just like sugar in the gas tank kind of thing. And so that's like the oh my God side effect, right? Not common, but pretty bad. And so but the more common side effect, and the one that is also pretty clearly established, is that statins, more in women than in men, but in men as well, increase the rate of development of diabetes, which, as I said in the show, diabetes is a risk multiplier. If you're diabetic, it basically, your risk of whatever, whether it's cancer, dementia, heart disease, you jump 10 years.
Wow.
So you've got the 50-year-old has the risk of a 60-year-old, the 60-year-old has the risk of a 70-year-old. And so getting, you know, having really good control of your blood sugar gets rid of most of that if you can do it without taking insulin.
So the blood sugar relationship and insulin, how does that correlate with the use of statins and LDL?
Well, okay, it depends on the circumstance. So again, we're getting back to the fact that if the person has diabetes, then we're starting, but if they did, we would be we would double the risk just mentally, and we'd say, all right, we're going to treat for 6%, not 12% 10-year risk.
Okay.
And so that's, you know, there may be a little bit of a false premise in there, but that's what we do. We really worry about our diabetics, and we're aggressive about treating them. And I agree with that. I can't get all of my diabetics to take statins. Some of them just react very poorly to them, and they'll get muscle aches. And if they get muscle aches on their statins, and I'll load them up with CoQ10 for a couple of weeks, retry with the statin. And if they still get muscle aches, I'm like, all right, no, I can't even calculate your risk for rhabdo, but we are keeping those kidneys. So,
I did have reactions to other statins that I took previously, not so much this one at this very low dose.
What kind of reactions?
Muscle cramps.
Yeah. So that's
feeling nausea.
Exactly. Yeah. And lately the doctors have been, again, purely cosmetic, no data to support it whatsoever. They've been giving a second drug called Estimibe or Revia. And Revia works by lowering, by essentially not letting you reabsorb the cholesterol from your food or bile. So it goes right through you, but it does lower your cholesterol levels, but it does not have any impact. There's plenty of data showing it doesn't do anything for your event rate for heart attacks. So you can make the LDL pretty, but you can't get the benefit because it's not about LDL. It's about inflammation. And so getting back to the insulin situation, if a diabetic is using 100 units of insulin a day in order to have good blood sugar, I'm happy they have good blood sugar. That's going to really help with their eyeballs and their kidneys. But that amount of insulin is very inflammatory all by itself. Insulin's an inflammatory hormone. So it's going to, what LDL you've got is going to get supercharged by all that insulin. So it really gets complicated fast when you start introducing multiple variables. I mean, just think about an ecosystem. You've got drainage, you've got light, you've got northern exposure, southern exposure. It's not just sunlight and water.
No, it's not. Indeed.
So,
thank you so much. This is great information. I really appreciate everything you're doing here and your show and everything else. I thank you so much for all of this.
Well, thank you. And tune in next week. I'll be back.
I certainly will. We'll talk soon. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.